Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Everybody's on human time.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 163, a talk with Illmind. Illmind is a producer, educator, and entrepreneur. Raised in New Jersey, but now residing in Brooklyn, he first gained notice for making beats for some of underground rap's best talent, like Little Brother, Acrobatic, Helter Skelta, and two-time Cipher guest Sky Zoo. It wasn't long after that when he broke into the mainstream, creating songs for Kanye West, Drake, J. Cole, Ludacris, and more. He also has a group of businesses aimed at helping aspiring producers, from his BLAP beat battles, to his Blap Kit drum sound packages, to personal mentorships. In addition, he's an accomplished educator and now a label head with his Rosewood Music Group. We talked to Illmind at his studio in Brooklyn. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. After you do that, make sure to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another great producer and one of Illmind's peers, Jake One, on episode 129. Also, consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecipher show and sign up. If a quarter of our listeners contributed even a dollar a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. For August, we've got some extras from our Chino BYI episode. He talks repelling taggers, European graffiti, and a famous actress who had her graffiti artist boyfriend stolen by a future huge pop star. Become a patron by August 12th at noon Eastern to get access to the file. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's the man with the top-secret whiteboard, Illmind. If you dig deep in online, you can actually find your SoundClick page.
Yeah.
And there are,
oh no! Here we go.
Yeah. So there's a couple beats on there.
Oh,
even there's like two original beats on there plus some of the Black Album remixes.
Yes.
Which I'll ask you about in a second. But yeah. Like even those two beats are pretty varied. One's like kind of, I don't even know if you remember them, probably not, but one's kind of like the soul sample, kind of sped up sample stuff, and one is like a little more rockish. Seemed like even at that early point in your career, you were concerned with variety. Is that a fair way to characterize it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, first of all, props for digging that up, because that brings back memories just thinking about that page. I'm pretty sure my profile picture was
a couple porn stars. Yeah.
that was like super early on in my career. Like that was me just kind of starting making beats, probably like a couple years in.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that was like way before SoundCloud and everything. SoundClick, as we all know, was like one of the first, you know, sites like Host Music. I think the stuff on that page, if I remember correctly, was like stuff I was currently working on, mm-hmm. including the Jay-Z Black Album remixes that I did.
Can I get an encore? Do you want more? Cooking raw with the Brooklyn boys. So for one last time, I need y'all to brawl. You grew up with holes in your zapper toes. You celebrate the minute you was having dough. I'm like, fuck critics, you could kiss my whole asshole. If you don't
So yeah, it was pretty much just like a collection of stuff I was working on at the time. But I think that page is a pretty good example of kind of like the where I was creatively at that time. And even like a few years before that page, I put that page up. I remember always being into a lot of different types of music. So even my early beats were a kind of an early sign of me being influenced by, you know, from J Dilla to like RZA, and then like, you know, fucking Limp Bizkit and like, you know, rock and pop and stuff like that. So that was like kind of an early kind of introduction to like what I was really into. Yeah. I think, yeah.
And the Black Album stuff, you know, not long after you put it out, there was a Times article.
Yeah.
That mentioned, you know, it was like, here are all the hot Black Album remixes, and it mentioned you.
We'll link it in the show notes.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea that was coming out?
Well, no, I didn't know it was coming out, but that article, man, you're bringing me back. That article was like a huge point of validation for me at the time. I guess that was one of those like, you know, like landmarks in my career where it was like, wow, like, holy shit, how'd I get into the Times, you know? And then it was like alongside, you know, like I think it was Jahan from The Business, who are homies of mine. They've gone on to do really amazing things. And then like Kev Brown had his remix album on there. And of course, the Grey album with the Beatles and everything. So yeah, it was just, I felt really honored to be in that article. I didn't know it was happening, but just to kind of have that happen was like an early kind of like benchmark for me in my career. So yeah, I was happy about that.
Yeah. And a lot of the early beats you did had that kind of like sped up soul thing that was so popular at the time.
First of all, look at too long, so keep your eyes open.
Yeah. Just putting some shit down for my area. The terror and red in your area.
Between the lines, you can see the vision.
Did you get that from Kanye, or was that kind of from RZA, or just elsewhere in the world?
That was like, that originated from RZA. And like early Alchemist type stuff.
Yo, I bring it to these niggas with the foulest method.
And then when Kanye started doing it.
Yo, G, they can't stop me from rapping, can they? Can they hop?
That was like, you know, like just a confirmation for me that like I probably should fuck with it. You know what I mean? Because Kanye was always like one of my favorite like beat makers, even before like all the madness. So yeah, man, I think it was just one of those moments where it was like a really just inspiring sound at the time.
Yeah.
And it was like, I was just like, yeah, why not just do it and try it and like do it in my own way, you know?
Yeah. And I think one of the first things I heard, one of the first artists you work with was Jahan.
In a China club, I'm trying to find some bud. And I don't give a fuck, dog, dime a dub, until I'm high enough and then it's time to run. But Tommy's like,
yo, Jahan, you want to rhyme or what?
No doubt.
Yeah.
So who was he?
Oh my God, you're bringing me back. So Jahan was actually my brother's coworker. So my brother, no one knows this. So Jahan was actually like one of the first cats to like rap over my stuff. So I think I'm pretty sure I was still in high school or like first year of college. My brother is an accountant and he worked at this company and he had a coworker who was also an accountant. But then he also so happened to be a rapper. You know, my brother obviously knew I was like messing around, making beats and stuff like that. So he was like, yo, I got this, you know, this guy that I work with. He raps, you know, he's pretty dope. And maybe you guys can like do a track. Maybe he can like rap over one of your beats. And now I like at that time, I was like stoked because no one had ever rapped over my beats before. Long story short, I ended up linking up with Jahan and he actually became a good friend of mine. He's a really cool dude. And we got into the studio. I think it was in Philly. I don't remember exactly where we were, but we got into a studio and we recorded a few songs. And that was like the first experience, one of the first experiences of me being in a natural studio and having a rapper like actually rap on my beats. So that was like super memorable for me. So shout to Jahan for that, man. That's crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, amongst your early stuff, at least to me, it seems like when you listen to the stuff you did with Superstition, you kind of almost hear you growing in terms of thinking about arrangements.
Now I got, you got, we got. Super Dynamite, Super and LB. Together we both legging the blueprint. We hot y'all, the top dogs, the next move. Yo, the stress got my mind racing. It's testing my patience. I guess that I'm anxious to see if I can justify greatness and prove once and for all to y'all that I'm talented. My man, 7, yo, we up in the spot now. Equinox, yo, we up in the place now. Ill Mind, yo, we up in the spot now. So if you ain't fam, get the fuck out my face now.
Can you talk about that? Because it seems like you really are kind of experimenting with drops and different sounds, and like that seemed to be a particular growing point for you.
Definitely. Shout to Superstition. Yeah, my experience working with him was definitely a benchmark for me, because it was my sort of early experience of actually producing. So I kind of went from, you know, just making beats with no real regard for arrangement or like song to now, okay, I'm working with this guy, Superstition. He's an amazing rapper. He does amazing hooks. He's got some stuff on retail. He has a fan base. You know, he's a really big fan of my beats. Let me go ahead and be a producer. So I think that album in particular was sort of like my first experience being involved as a real producer. So, yeah, I mean, at that point in my career, it was all about not only making beats, but also creating with intentions of having a vocalist on there. So like that approach is completely different. Like you have to really think about, you know, leaving space for the vocalist. You have to think about arrangement, like you said, what the hook is going to be and what kind of song it's going to be, setting the mood. So yeah, that was a huge benchmark for me. Shout to Superstition.
Yeah. And you know, this idea of collaborating with vocalists, you know, you would go on to do full-on albums, collaborative records with different vocalists. And I was thinking about stuff like the record you did with Skyzoo and the one with Joel Ortiz. When you're in that kind of situation and you realize at whatever point in the process, like we're doing an album and it's going to be me and you, how involved are you with the subject matter? Do they say, oh, I want to write about this. I need a beat that sounds, you know, sad or melancholy or nostalgic or whatever. Like, how does that work?
You know what? It's funny because with those two specific guys, they're so good at what they do, and they have so much to talk about. I think with the Skyzoo Live from the Tape Deck album and with this Human album with Joel, it was more of a case of us sort of like building on different topics and different like places in their careers that they are, and not so much being super detailed with like, okay, this song has to be about a girl, this song has to be about this, but more so, you know, what are we trying to accomplish right now? And I think my job in those situations was just to paint the picture and set the scene up for them. And I like to kind of compare it to, you know, shooting a movie, where it's like my job as the music producer is to set up the scene. So I'm the guy that's bringing the props in. I'm the guy that's, you know, choosing what types of cameras to use, what kind of angles, what kind of scene, what kind of colors and stuff like that. And it's the vocalist's job to come in and actually create, you know, tell the story. So I think with them, it was really easy for me to work with them on that, because they're just so good at what they do. And they're such good people that it made my job easy. So, yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of, you know, brainstorming and communicating and kind of feeding each other ideas. But it was more so of me kind of just like getting on the same wavelength and then just creating the music from there based off of feeling. Mm-hmm.
And was it always like that with Sky? Because you've worked with him on pretty much every project that he's done in some form or other.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, people say all the time, like, and Sky says himself, like, I'm like his 40, basically, mm-hmm. You know, and it's true. I mean, especially with the early stuff, you know, I was attracted to Sky's music early on. And he's one of the best writers to me to date. And so, I think, you know, when I connect with an artist, especially with Skyzoo, I, without even really thinking about it, I want to be involved more than just like, you know, hey, Sky, here's a zip file of 20 beats, pick what you want and put it on the album. It's more, okay, let's sit down together. Let me make this beat from scratch, or let me track the vocals. Let me help you determine, you know, the direction of this project and really be an executive producer, quote unquote, on that. So that's kind of how our workflow has been.
Yeah. And unfortunately, there are times when you can't do that with a lot of artists. You don't have personal relationships or higher profile artists, you know, people like the kind of the Drakes and Kanye's of the world. Mm. I know you like to be in the studio with an artist. And then, you know, sometimes in those cases, it can't happen. Do you think the end result of those songs would be better if you had the chance to sit down with them and actually work on the songs?
I think so. You know, I think so. But then on the flip side, I think it's case by case. I think sometimes, you know, magic can happen from, you know, J. Cole just hearing one of my beats and then him just being touched by it so much to write an amazing song to that.
Heart beating fast, let a nigga know that he alive. Fake niggas, mad snakes, snakes in the grass, let a nigga know that he arrived. Don't be sleeping on your level, cause it's beauty in the struggle, nigga.
Other times we can get in the studio and build from scratch and really, you know, flush out ideas, you know, more in that way. But I think it's case by case. I don't know. I think it's a crapshoot because, you know, there's sometimes when I'll be in the studio with an artist and we'll be booked for, you know, the whole day, 8 hours and like not make anything.
Nothing happens.
You know, and nothing happens. Yeah. And then like I end up leaving and then like send them a beat and then they end up using one of those. So yeah, so it's really unpredictable, but just I like being in the studio with the artist because to me, there's nothing better than that human-to-human connection you have with someone.
Right.
And I think it's always going to be beneficial to know the person better. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And the high profile, some of the high profile records you had, I didn't realize this because, you know, how would I know? But the beats end up being 2 or 3 years old by the time, you know, they hear them and record to them and the thing comes out. Is that ever frustrating where you're like, okay, I got this high profile placement, but I don't sound like that anymore. I'm right. So much better than I was.
You know what? Not anymore. It used to bother me. And the reason why it used to bother me was because, you know, there was this sort of like stigma for producers where, you know, people would discover you through album credits. So like mm-hmm. if I got a placement on a high profile record and I did that beat 3 years prior to it coming out, you know, and if this was like, you know, 2001 or whatever, for example, there would be no SoundCloud, there would be no Twitter, you know, Instagram and all that stuff. So the only way for people to really figure out my name is if a blog mentioned me or if they looked at the album credit. And so I was never mad at that, but back then it was a lot more frustrating because it was like, fuck, like, they only can hear my music when I get a placement. But nowadays, because of the social medias and because of the ability to brand yourself and drop beat tapes and all that stuff, I don't get bothered by it at all because, mm-hmm. you know, I sort of like make it known that it's like, okay, you know, I have a placement on a Drake album.
And look, I hate it when you hate on all my girlfriends and assistants, always convinced that there's someone better, like that girl from your gym who trains you. I know you want to arrange it. You told me she's free Thursday, and I'm sure that she's an angel, but she don't want this.
I'm pushing the current, you know, beat tape or whatever it is I'm working on at that time as well. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it gives me a little bit more control on what people are hearing.
You know, you were one of the first producers to really make a name for yourself on the internet.
Mm.
I was just wondering how that was, because you were in a sense in uncharted territory, right? You were like the first generation of internet producers. What was it like to be on sort of this whole new landscape and not really have a roadmap?
Man, it was like being in another world, man. Like, you know, the idea of being able to connect with other people online, like people that you've never met, that whole experience at such a young age, so early on in the age of the internet, was definitely surreal for me. So I'm actually really, you know, humbled and glad that I was able to experience that because that's obviously the norm now.
Yeah.
So I think also too, because of that experience, it kind of gives me a little bit more of an upper hand on how interactions on the internet work and the importance of being able to brand myself through my social media and stuff like that. Because I've been doing it a lot longer than a lot of people, maybe right. not all people, but a lot of people, especially as a music producer. So yeah, I think it's great, man. Like, you know, the power of the internet. I mean, it was able to get the Illmind name out and it's still growing every day. So it feels good.
What were the forums like in those early days?
Man, just like, you know, HTML, click, you know, low quality MP3, mono,
right.
you know, just, but very interactive. I mean, it felt pretty similar, you know, like I used to go on undergroundhiphop.com message board forums. And it kind of felt like Twitter, you know, it was like threads with different subjects, and you click in them, and then you go into the thread, and then you have a bunch of comments, and you reply. So it was, low key, it was like an early version of Twitter, honestly.
Right.
But it felt the same because I knew I was speaking to other people that were, that I shared common interests with.
Mm-hmm.
It was just happening a lot slower, but it felt kind of the same.
Right. Are you ever like, you kids today, your songs upload so fast, I had to, set it up before I went to bed and maybe it would be done by the time I wake up?
Yeah, I mean, shit. We used to upload fucking, like I said, like dial-up, telephone dial-up, like mono MP3s at like super low quality.
Right.
And that was the wave. But yeah, it's changed now, man.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things I've noticed about your production style is, you don't sample much anymore,
mm-hmm.
but when you did, it was almost never the kind of like very recognizable, underground breaks and beats style samples. I think in all of your stuff I listened to, I heard, Long Red once.
You out there? Louder!
After checking, we actually found 3 songs, but for a track that's been sampled nearly 600 times, it's really not that much.
On tempo, yeah!
This is what you find. The good news is, nigga, you came a long way. The bad news is, nigga, you went the wrong way.
They don't understand. I was raised by the vultures. Kill laughing like a hyenas in the crib full of roaches. Go grandmama, mommy, cause mommy already dead. Daddy been missing since I was a little kid. Now who there goes dead playing.
Like big beat once.
I got the big beat.
Yeah. Let him know the sign.
Listen. We stomped through so many rap wars and rap awards. Boot camp click, been on your front line blasting off.
Why avoid those kind of breaks?
You know what inspired me to do that was Madlib and J Dilla. I mean, those two guys in hip hop production, in my opinion, they're like master diggers. Like they find the most obscure like world records that you've never heard before, and even their drums, like. I can never pinpoint where they get their drums because they're just so good at finding rare shit.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I was just always inspired by that. Like, damn, like if those guys can find those samples, then why can't I, So when I used to go digging all the time, like I would avoid the soul sample section. I would go straight to the dollar bins or like the world music section mm-hmm. and just kind of digging that way. I kind of built up this habit of just wanting to be different.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of working,
Yeah. One of the things, I know that when you do pop songs, you tend to think, less in terms of like sounds and grooves and kind of more in terms of chords and stuff. And that got me thinking about the song Rain you did with Acrobatic, which mm-hmm. I don't even know if you remember, but it's maybe like the more elaborate sort of longer chord progression than a mm-hmm. lot of your other tunes.
Yeah, when it rains, it pours. Globalization putting poison in the stores. Tidal waves washing good people off the shores. Sometimes I feel like I can't take it no more. I see white and black ladies.
Can you talk sort of generally how you think about chords and chord progressions when you're making songs?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit it on the nose. Like the chord progressions are more of a focal point in my production when it comes to pop music or like working with a vocalist. That track with Acrobatic has a lot of like pop sensibility in there. I think, man, chords, good chords are universal language, man. They speak to everybody, and there's just so many different types of chords and different moods, minor, major, sevenths, all this stuff. So, yeah, I mean, lately when I'm kind of like creating music and I'm going real chord heavy, it's more for like the singer songwriter type of thing. But, mm-hmm. Again, I mean, the beauty of music now is that there's no limits, but, I think every piece of music should have some type of musicality to it,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that can be difficult in production, and you did this a lot in your early days, was to take samples and then add stuff to it. Right, add drums or a bass line or something like that. When you're doing that, what are your sort of limitations? How far can you go away from like the feel of the sample, the era or genre of the sample when you're adding parts?
I think when I'm sampling music, I'm always going to be at the mercy of what that sample is.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some different techniques. I mean, you can filter stuff out, obviously chopping and rearranging and stuff like that. But I think the creativity in sampling, I believe there aren't really any limits, depending on how well you could, you know, really transform that sample. I mean, it's like cooking, you know, it's like transforming a fruit into, you know, a sauce or whatever it is. And you're putting all these ingredients together and, you know, layering different sounds and instruments on top of samples is just all part of the process. It's all like, it's all art, you know? So I think, yeah, I mean, you know, it all depends on how you flip it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're obviously put a lot of thought into your drum sounds, and we'll get into how you've managed to monetize that in a minute.
Yeah.
But one of the things you do a lot with your snare, you kind of mix a snare and a hand clap a lot.
Please keep on naming your mouse. How'd you get the words around my clip without taking it out?
Wow.
Amazing shit, neat old trick. Veto this bitch. See how I leave you screaming with your feet on your wrist.
Come on, track, man. So depressing. Johnny Phrase. Yeah.
The one and only.
Tony O. That's one on the track. It's one mind, yo. It's one life, yo.
Can you talk about maybe when you discover that and what you like about it?
Yeah. I mean, that's just influence from like a combination of like Dilla. And like early just like disco music. You know, just like my parents were big disco fans. So, just the combination of like the kick drum and the clap, and then sometimes hearing like a snare and a clap is just interesting. And also it's sort of like celebratory too, because you're picturing just like a crowd of people clapping
right
on the snare, and it just gives it that texture, that energy, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think a lot of my early stuff was definitely like layered, like clap, snare kind of combinations.
Yeah. And you tend not to quantize your drums so much, or at least you didn't at some point.
Mm-hmm.
a little bit or not all the way. For people who aren't super familiar with that, can you give kind of a brief explanation of what that is and how you not doing it makes you stand out?
Yeah, definitely. So the idea of quantizing is basically the computer fixing the groove for you. So if you
do something that's a little out of time.
Yeah, a little out of time. So like obviously, you know, with human touch, if I'm programming a drum pattern, I have a hi-hat, a kick, and a snare, and I do, you know, or something like that. Obviously, I'm a human, so my timing won't be exactly mathematically to the grid, depending on the beats per minute. So a computer will take that entire drum track or whatever track you're making and slide everything exactly to where it should be mathematically. So in certain situations, that's good. But in a lot of situations, that's bad because, you know, it sort of takes away that human feel. So when you think about early soul music, early disco music, you know, these guys weren't recording on the grid. They were just, you know, it was live band. It was a click track and they were all kind of doing it live and choosing their best takes. And I think that's really what contributed to the magic of the music back then. And that's why samples, quote unquote, sound so good, because everybody's on human time, right? So I just kind of like adopted that mentality in my music early on. And then again, I'll drop his name, Dilla, rest in peace. Like he was like the king of like the, you know, no quantize type thing. And I just kind of picked that technique up early and still to this day, like most of my stuff isn't quantized. Even like the hard like trap bass kind of stuff has a little bit of that groove in there.
Really? Even the kind of boom trap, super almost EDM type stuff.
Exactly.
Speaking of Dilla, you did a birthday tribute EP to him.
Yes.
A while ago. And the beats were very, very, very in his style. When you were thinking about doing that project, what kind of elements did you have to include to have a beat read as Dilla-esque?
You know what it was for me? It was the bass line and the drum groove, you know, and, you know, a little bit of sample selection, but more so the way that the drums were communicating with the bass. I think that's kind of like one of Dilla's like early signatures, was like his technique of programming a drum pattern and then having that bass line just like really speak with the drums. Depending on like where the kick drum hits and where the bass notes hit. So that was kind of my mentality with creating that project, was just like making sure I was, you know, my bass lines and my drum patterns were like Dilla-esque. Like, what would Dilla do, you right. know?
And so. It's so interesting because you can't actually use samples he used or whatever. It's not a cover.
Exactly.
Yeah. So your family is Filipino.
Yep.
And most Filipinos in largely speaking hip-hop, and even sort of going back to the disco era, have been DJs.
Yep.
And not producers.
For more about Filipino DJs, check out episode 103 with Oliver Wang.
So I guess I have two questions. First, do you feel yourself to be part of that lineage of Filipino DJs?
Yeah, definitely. My older cousins, when I was growing up in the 80s, my older cousins and even like my uncle, who's like in the 80s, he was like, you know, a DJ or whatever. They were all like record diggers, DJs, and you know, they were Filipino. So I just remember like when I was like really, really young, like they would make these like tapes where it was like side A would be like a house mix, side B would be like reggae, you know, and then they would do like a hip hop side A, R&B side B tape, and it would just be tapes. I just remember them making tapes with the pause tapes and the records and all that. So I actually adopted DJing like super early on. Like my uncle had a pair of, I think it was like Geminis or something. And he used to have like a nickel on top of the needle in order for the needle to work. Yeah, he would just like juggle in the basement and just like have records all around. And so like I remember messing around with DJing like probably when I was like 8 or 9 years old, before I even knew what like making beats was. So that was kind of like my first taste of like the DJ thing. And then like just kind of getting into hip hop and growing up in the music, like I started to notice like, wow, like there's a lot of really good Filipino DJs, like, you know, the Baboos of the world, the Rhythmatics of the world, the Q-Berts and everybody, you know, the Beat Junkies.
All the DJs Illmind mentions here are obviously Filipino. DJ Baboo is a member of Dilated Peoples along with Evidence and Ronka. DJ Rhythmatic was a member of the underground hip-hop supergroup The Visionaries and has worked with artists including Peanut Butter Wolf, Talib Kweli, Madlib, Cypress Hill, and Meyer Hawthorne. Both are members of the Beat Junkies, a seminal California-based DJ crew. DJ Cuber was one of the most renowned turntablists in the art and was a member of the Invisible Scratch Pickles, the revolutionary turntable crew. We talk a bunch about the Pickles in the Oliver Wang episode and episode 105 with RJD2.
And so, yeah, I mean, it kind of like put things into perspective, like, wow, like Filipinos are definitely involved heavily in not only music, but hip hop music, but in DJing, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a sense of pride there. Like, I'm definitely happy and humbled that, you know, my people are out there doing it like that. And those guys are a huge influence on me for sure. So
absolutely. You've worked with Little Brother for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even I guess you knew them even before their first album and stuff. When you're doing a song for a group like that with such a specific sound, and with them literally an in-house producer as a group member, when you're making beats, is Ninth Wonder sound in your head, or was Ninth Wonder sound in your head at all? Did you try to make something that would sound at all like him?
You know what? Not at all. Yeah, not at all. And the crazy thing about the Little Brother connection was it happened so organically. I mean, it was unbelievable. Like, I would say, I mean, for people that don't know like the exact history of it, so I met Ninth Wonder, Fonte, and Pooh from Little Brother, I would say 2001, 2002. This was right before The Listening came out. And so my man, Slop Funk Dust, who's a big homie, you know, I've known him. He was like one of the first cats I met on the Underground Hip Hop Forum. He sent me a few songs on MP3 through AIM. AOL AIM, goddammit.
Shouts to AOL
on the dial-up tip. And so he sent me a few songs, and he's like, yo, check these songs out. This group from North Carolina called Little Brother. And so he sent me Speed and Away From Me. Speeding down the roads of life. Yo, check it.
another day to face. I'm sharecropping in this paper chase. Take a deep breath and clear my database.
Hey, yo, what up, Reese? It's been a minute since we last spoke. Side by side, let's circle around mad folks. We tipped around each other, wishing we were still close. But I'm grown and it's tough for you to swallow.
And I heard that shit and I was like, yo, who are these guys? Like, who's doing these beats? This guy sounds like Pete Rock. Like, who they're from North Carolina. What's going on? So eventually I got a channel through them and I linked with them and we got to speak and I really got to know those guys. And like, I meant from there, it was like, you know, me and Ninth Wonder used to just like email each other beats all the time. Well, actually it's through AIM again, shout to AIM. I remember leaving my AOL, AIM screen name signed in and like, I'd come home and see like 10 MP3s on my desktop from Ninth Wonder. Cause he just sent me a bunch of beats. And I would send him beats and we just kind of hit it off early on. So I think we were kind of like just inspired by each other. You know, it was like it was the era of like the sample chop, the, you know, Pete Rock, Dilla influence, but kind of doing it in our own way.
Right.
So like on my old computer, at my mom's house, I have like probably like 500 or 600 unreleased Ninth Wonder beats just sitting on the hard drive. And he has a bunch of mine, but right. Yeah, that was kind of what it was. But working with Little Brother, it wasn't more of like, you know, creating what Ninth would make, but it was more like Fonte and Pooh heard my music and they were like, yo, your shit is dope. Like what you do is really good. We should work. And so I just kind of, you know, stayed on the path of just like creating music freely. Mm-hmm. And they just so happened to like the music I was making at that time. And that's how I ended up doing, a bunch of joints on the Get Back album and being like heavily involved in that.
They talk about us not using the word nigga. I want to speak about a couple issues much bigger. Like most black folk live below the poverty line and they wonder why the fuck we attracted the crime.
Yo, listen. I used to do it for the fans till I realized that they never understand what I was feeling as a man. Fickle as Trav Bickle, they either hating you or they a stand. I used to go to the mall with $40 a hand. It ain't matter at all, cause I could go see my man down at South Square Mall working at J. Riggins. Oh no, manager leave, he let me cop for the low low.
With a right hand, my man 50 grand. Us getting dollars was all part of the plan. A few years back, we cut ties, you understand. It was all business, nothing personal. And you vowed to come back a different person now. We are back on track.
And, you know, to get to the business side of your career for a minute, you have made a whole bunch of side businesses and efforts and stuff based around the fact that a lot of your audience is aspiring producers. How did you come to realize that? And did you have any resistance to that at first?
You know what? Looking back at it now, like I never resisted it. It's crazy because in realizing that, you know, producers were a big part of my fan base and I was obviously a producer, so I'm a fan of other producers and I'm sure it's true with the Pete Rocks of the world and the Dillas of the world, you know, a lot of their fan bases are producers. So I was just always attracted to like-minded people, you know, all the way down to the Beat Society and all the live producer showcases I've done over the years. It's just, I really, really, truly enjoy being around other producers and other people because we have things in common. So when I decided to, you know, kind of like start these sort of side businesses that tailor to the music producer, I would always put myself in their shoes and say, hey, you know, like, what did I not have when I was coming up? Mm-hmm. What can I do right now with my leverage to influence the producer community and help the producer community? And that was kind of like the birth of all of these other kind of side businesses that I have going on.
Right. And with Blap, with the live element, the live beat showcases you do...
Illmind created Blap, or Beats Love Alcohol Party, to give producers both known and unknown an opportunity to showcase their beats in front of a party, rather than the typical showcases and battles done for industry pros. The goal, according to the website, is to let producers show they can keep a crowd rocking.
Who what did you want to do with it that was different than the beat battles you'd been to? And also, like, when you finally put on an event, what surprised you about it?
It was the raw aspect of it. You know, it was just like a table set up just like this with, you know, beat machines and laptops. And eventually it evolved to all laptops. But let's just say a table with like 5-6 laptops, bunch of hard drives, and an aux cable. You know, just like what Kanye did at the Garden.
Right.
Same thing. And it was the idea of just plugging the aux cable in and playing your shit. Stuff that people haven't heard before. Stuff that's just raw in your hard drive. Like beats that you probably did yesterday that no one's heard before playing for a club. Mm-hmm. That idea is exciting to me. And I know I get excited if I was, you know, sitting there with my laptop and like, you know, people in the club packed out ready to hear my beats, like I'd be super excited in that position. So I wanted to create a live event that kind of, you know, was conducive to that.
Yeah.
That event. So so I started BLAP, Beats Love Alcohol Party, and then those words exactly define what it is. You know, it's just a bunch of us producers with our laptops with the aux cable, and we just kind of go round robin, play beats, and mm-hmm. and people vibe out. And that's really the bulk of the event, yeah.
On your blog and in a lot of other places, you talk about the importance of networking. Was that something that came naturally to you, or is that something you sort of had to sit down and really be conscious and try and work on?
I definitely had to learn that. I mean, early on, you know, I just wanted to be in my room and make beats all day. So when I discovered that, oh, okay, you know, there's people out there that want to meet me, and there's people that I want to meet, and oh, there's also people my age that are making beats and trying to get out there and work with artists and stuff like that. So I think because of that, I would, you know, I was kind of going out of my way to travel more, to meet more people, go to more events, and that kind of like opened me up. You know, that was like, those years were like the years that like broke me out of my shell. It went from like just being in my room to now, you know, meeting other people that do the same thing and kind of broadening my network. So yeah, I mean, it was definitely something that I grew into, something I learned through experience, just like meeting people and picking up all these little like tidbits and techniques of how to meet new people and how to, you know, what kind of impression to leave and all that different shit. Mm-hmm. And then like I started getting into books and just reading a ton of books on like interacting with other people and networking and then all these concepts and stuff. So it was just like something that I was like fascinated by. Mm-hmm. And so I apply those today.
Yeah. I noticed one of the businesses you have is you sell these kind of virtual mentorships. Mm-hmm. To up and coming producers for, I think it's a monthly fee. Mm-hmm. They can text you or email you and you can send feedback and you send, you know, video streams of you in the studio and stuff. Mm-hmm. How is that working out? Do you find it good? Do you find it taking up more time than you thought? Like how is that going?
It's incredible. It's everything about it is amazing. I love it so much. It's basically a monthly membership called the Illmind Platinum Club. And for the monthly fee, you get a bunch of things. I mean, you get my phone number, you can text me anytime, you know, and I try to get back to people as quickly as possible. And then it's just a plethora of content. I mean, you have video content. I have video cameras on me all day, every day.
There's one in here right now?
Yeah, there's one filming us right now. I have video cameras running the entire time I'm in the studio Monday through Friday. So I'm feeding my members with exclusive studio content, me creating beats, me in the studio with different artists, me and my A&Rs, you know, just chatting about different business ventures and stuff like that. So it's really just an opportunity for my fans to feel like they're in the room with me. Mm-hmm. You know, they feel like they're in the studio with me every day. They get exclusive music from me too. You know, some days I just feel like sharing music. So I'll hit my club like, hey guys, here's a new MP3, a beat I made, here you go. Oh, and by the way, here are the drums, go crazy, you know? And then I'll do tutorial videos of just like stuff I've learned over the years in Pro Tools.
Hey, what's going on, guys? It's your boy Illmind, and welcome to the official Rump Shaker, Illmind Rump Shaker Special Edition Blab Kit video tutorial.
Just everything and anything that Illmind is involved with, I feed to the club, and I really like spoiling them because like the club members are my real fans. They're like my hardcore fans that, you know, some of them aren't even producers. They just want to be connected with me. And, wow, and that's really special and super humbling. So I want to do everything I can to just spoil my club members. So,
is that why you don't do a ton of the like beat breakdown videos for other sites that a lot of producers do? You kind of keep that stuff.
That's exactly why I don't. Yeah, that's exactly why I don't. And you know, you might see more pop up in the future here and there kind of as one-offs. Just for some visibility and to just give the other community some stuff. But I definitely like to keep most of that content in-house, because what I've realized is that a lot of my value is in content. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, thinking in terms of the business aspect of it, you know, I'm able to streamline all of that content directly to the people, directly from me. And that's essentially what the club is.
And so one of the things you do is you sell packs of your sounds that you've mm-hmm. used on songs, particular, you know, drum sounds, keyboard sounds, things like that. Once you include sounds in packages like that, do you ever use them again?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, wow. the way that I kind of do it is when I create a new drum kit, like for instance, the newest one that came out, Blap Kit Volume 8, plug. At this point, everyone's got it. I mean, you know. And so what I do is when I create a drum kit, I'll create those exact drum sounds that I'm making from scratch are the same drum sounds that I use in my own production. And the thing I've realized over the past probably four and a half, five years that I've been releasing sounds is that even with access to my sounds and my instruments and stuff like that, producers out there always have their own way of flipping those sounds, and they always end up just sounding different. So I mean at first for me it was, you know, I did have a few moments where I was like, all right, well, if I put my sounds out, then everyone's going to sound like Illmind. But what I've discovered is that no one can sound like Illmind, you know, only I can. So, and that was really exciting for me to discover that. So essentially what's happening is I'm doing is just, you know, providing the tools to inspire these producers out here to create at the highest quality possible. And it's actually happening, and I feel good about that.
Yeah. One of the things that producers had, you know, in the time you were starting and kind of the generation before was, and I've talked to a ton of producers about this, was this whole set of unwritten rules, right? About what was okay to sample, what wasn't, you know, you can't get beats from compilations, you know, this and that, like this whole sort of textbook of things you could and couldn't do. That is just changing so rapidly. And I bring this up because you were talking about how, you know, you can find samples online and how that used to be taboo, but it's kind of becoming less and less taboo with every passing year. As a producer and as someone who's kind of seen the rules change over the past 10 or 15 years, what are your thoughts about how kind of the rule book is changing of what's acceptable for producers?
Man, people are going to hate me for this, but like I like the fact that there are no rules. I just think it gives the producer more options. It gives the producer a bigger palette to work with. And it's like, why were those rules in place in the first place? I mean, you know, the goal for the producer is to create the best music possible. And so technology evolving has allowed for us to do that. So why have this rule where it's like, well, if you're going to sample, then, you know, it has to be a piece of vinyl. And if you sample from YouTube, then you suck. You know, it's like, that's not true. You know, that's like, that's just an example of denying technology for whatever reason. And I don't think the reason justifies the idea to not sample from YouTube or grab your samples from the internet. I mean, it's free game at this point. You know, it's like saying, you know, fuck that, I don't use cell phones. I got that dial up. I'm keeping it real. It's like, no, like you're way behind, you know? So any type of technology improvement that contributes to producers creating better music, I'm always going to co-sign that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, to me, I love it all. I think there are no rules. As long as it's helping you produce better music, I'm all for it.
So a while ago, we had Jake One on the show. And he,
shout out to Jake.
Yeah. And you guys had the same management for a while. You mm-hmm. overlapped with Shamani and Deep Prosper, who, you know, both had close connections to G-Unit. During that period, did you feel a sense of competition with the other producers in that stable?
Oh, yeah. first of all, shout to Sha Money. I mean, everybody that was signed to Sha Money at the time, I was all humongous fans of them. And they were all amazing producers. I mean, you had Jake One, you had Black Jeruse, you had The Business, High Tech. I mean, these guys are mega, mega amazing. So I think there was always sort of this sense of like, you know, friendly competition. But I think that's what allowed for us to thrive. It was like, okay, well, like I'm going to make beats, but like I need to make sure I'm on the same level or at a higher level than a Jake One or a High Tech or whatever. So I think we all kind of adopted that mentality and just always wanted to outdo each other. But that's what contributed to the music being better.
Looking back on the stuff you made in that period, I guess it was circa 05 or whatever, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that maybe you adapted your style to what a G-Unit would want to hear at all?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I was...
Were you aware of it at the time?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was so conscious. Like, I was... At the time, I just was always a huge G-Unit fan. Like, when 50 came out with his album, I was obsessed with it. Like, and that was... It was a funny time in hip-hop, because that was like, oh, you know, you listen to, like, Raucous and, like, Native Tongues, and, like, you either listen to that or, like, Ja Rule, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, DMX maybe a little bit, and, like, Tribe and stuff like that. But, like... And then 50 came and just smashed everyone, but his shit was slapping. His shit was always super dope. So I was always a huge fan of the G-Unit sound and like all those solo projects that they came out with in the compilation. And so, yeah, I think the G-Unit connection kind of happened organically in my mind because I was making beats like that. A lot, you know?
Yeah, even before
Before it happened. Wow. And the way it happened was D Prosper reached out to me on MySpace. This was like 05. It was like early 05. And he was like, yo, I heard some of your beats, blah, blah, blah. Send me some beats. I'm looking for 50 or whatever. So I sent him like 30 beats and they were all G-Unit type shit. Like shit that I want 50 Cent to rap over.
Yeah.
And I guess that beat tape was good enough for him to say, yo, Sha Money wants to meet you. We want to do a management deal with you. And that's how it happened. So I was already kind of like early adopted into the G-Unit thing.
Wow. And why did you ultimately leave that situation?
You know, I think we just kind of grew apart. Not apart in a negative way, but I think creatively we all kind of grew. It was at the point where the internet was changing, the sounds were changing, even the stuff they were doing was changing. The way they were operating was changing. So there was a lot of changes happening, a lot of growing from everyone. I think Sha was growing. I think definitely I was growing, Jake and everyone. So, yeah, I think it was just it came a point in time where it was like, man, like how much more can we do of this? You know, we all have our sort of aspirations of doing more. And that was coincidentally around the time when I started getting more into producing pop music and going from like, oh, I'm a hardcore hip hop producer to now like, let me showcase my other abilities as well. So for me personally, it was more of like a creative growth. I think I kind of grew out of it.
It was a weird time in that I feel like so many producers of that era were tied in some way or another into the Dre G-Unit machine, right? It seemed like, you know, basically... And we've had a bunch of them on the show, people like Focus and things like that, who mm-hmm. were all in one way or another in that world.
Yeah, definitely. That was everything. I mean, for people that remember that are old enough, the 50 Cent G-Unit run was so serious. And that was the Eminem run with it. And it was Dre. And it was the dominant force in urban music. And if you weren't involved with it, then you weren't, you know what I mean? You weren't really... doing it, unless you were like the Timbo or the Swizz or the Neptunes. Those guys were always killing it. But for a mid-level sort of producer like myself back then and like all of us that were kind of like on the come up and like doing it, it was like, man, you got to get with G-Unit, you know? So, yeah, it was an exciting time, man. And I actually really miss like those beats.
Yeah.
Like I miss that.
Nice. Maybe we'll get bring them back.
Yeah, we should. Let's go.
So... You mentioned Timbaland there a second mm-hmm. ago, and you did a song with him, that kind of Star Wars novelty thing.
The Force will be with you always.
But that got me thinking about, you know, when you work with Timbaland or with Swiss Beats, like you did on that one song.
I got some customers, they waiting on me. I got some chicks, they be waiting on me. I got some haters, they be waiting on me. I'm never on time, so they waiting on me.
What does a collaboration with a producer on that level look like? Like, what's the workflow?
Man, it's not as crazy as people think it is. You know what I mean? Like, me and Swizz, you know, we know each other on a personal level. So, like, we speak on the phone and talk about random shit and all that stuff. And so for those two particular collaborations, I mean, the Timbaland song we did called The Force happened, A, because we're both huge, huge Star Wars fans. B, because the Force Awakens was just coming out. And C, you know, that I was kind of coming off of doing a campaign, an official campaign with Hewlett Packard and Star Wars for a second song, another song that I did for Star Wars. So I think we just me and Tim came together like, yo, like I showed him like the idea and, you know, he called me and we were chopping it up on the phone. At first he was like, yo, I want to use this as like my intro to like this tape I'm about to put out, which is the tape he put out. And then we're like, yo, like Star Wars is coming out like next week. Why don't we just like line it up with the release and like put it out like as a Timbo Illmind thing. And just, you know, feed it out to him. And it's like, they won't expect it. It's like some turn up, like Star Wars fun shit.
Yeah.
So that was just like a super like nerd moment for us, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm obviously like super humbled to even have worked with Tim. He's one of my favorites. He's one of the greatest of all time, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that whole time was super fun. And with Swizz, it was just like, it's super simple, you know? It's like, we just collaborate on the beat. Like that was, you know, so my man A-Rab Music was at Swizz's crib, and A-Rab played him a bunch of beats and played him some sample loops and stuff like that. And Swizz heard one of them, and A-Rab was like, yo, what is that? Like, can I flip that? And he was like, yeah, that's Illmind. And he was like, oh, shit, all right. So then Swizz called me, and we were chopping it up. And I knew Swizz before we collaborated, but this was the first time he's actually, like, you know, collaborating with me. And then from there, we just kind of went back and forth, hashed it out. And then, like, I heard the final song, and that was that. So, like, that was all Swizz, man. Like, Swizz, like, led that ship. That was his thing. Yeah. So, and shout to A-Rab for helping, you know, move that along.
Yeah. And one musical, kind of back to the musical style stuff. I was listening to House Slippers, the song.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts out with, you know, one single drum pattern. And that pattern never goes away throughout the whole song. It just kind of gets embellished on.
The grind took forever, but it happened fast. Listen close, y'all, it happened fast. Red eye flights out to Cali, sign an aftermath. Come back and sign a Koch, you and Alan laugh. You drop an album over here, left the label over there. Finally let it go, y'all, the past, the past. Sorry for the... I just wanted to pick your brain a little bit about the thoughts about, like, developing musical ideas in a song. Like, how do you think about that? Yeah, I mean, I kind of look at it like telling a story. It's like, you know, you set the tone, you set the mood, what kind of movie it is, you start to introduce the characters. So I think in that particular track, you know, starting with the drums that were kind of like filtered out a little bit and introducing a simple melody was kind of like me introducing the characters. Hmm. And then as sort of the song is progressing, the characters are evolving, they're starting to tell a story, they start to become more present in the track, and then they kind of like communicate and weave and you know, with Joelle on there, it really just kind of completes the entire thought. So that's kind of my approach with all my production. It's like, how can I tell a story without words? You know, how can I set a feeling and introduce certain characters? Like every sound, every instrument, every riff that I put in my beats, they're all people to me. Everyone's a character, you know? So that's kind of how I envision it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And I know classical music is a big influence, mm-hmm, on you, to the point where you even quoted Fur Elise, and that's how this song.
Yeah.
Mets before we converted to Islam. House burglar, wake up and your shit gone.
That was it.
We'll just talk about that for a second. How did that, was that like a goof that you decided to end up keeping? Like, how did that
come about? Yeah, it was. I was just like, fuck it, let me just use this. And I did it. And then, like, you know, P, rest in peace, Sean Price, like, they, him and Rock heard it. And Drew Ha from Duck Down hit me like, yo, they want to use that joint. And we ended up doing everything.
Were you kind of like, are you serious? Like, I didn't really.
At first, I was like, in my mind, I'm like, damn, that one? That's crazy. And then, you know, we got in the studio and then I heard it. And then, like, we shot a video and it ended up being super amazing. So, yeah, that was just one of those moments. I just had to sneak in that little, like, I don't just sample soul records. Here you go.
Right. Yeah. I know Beethoven too.
Yeah.
Totally. And classical music seems to have worked its way into like how you think about melody too, and like both the sounds you use, string sounds and stuff like that, and also kind of how the melodies are, how they sound, how they're composed a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never kiss the ring. I'd rather storm the castle, kill the king, then set fire to fucking everything.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, classical music is kind of the birth of music, isn't it? In a way, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Modern music, at least. Yep.
Yeah. One of the things about the Kanye song that ended up in Cruel Summer, you've talked about it a lot and how it happened. I guess one of the craziest things to me is that you actually sent him, or not him, but, you know, his Rhyme Fest and his right-hand man and his camp, 100 beats, 100 plus beats before they ended up choosing one.
In the crib, sitting and counting, smoking the split. This shit's a gift. All my niggas' watches is rough. Grabbing our crotches, yelling, what up? The jeans cost 500. Fuck. Stop and keep baking. See the smell, it's a statement. One freeze of this shit, you won't feel your legs, kid. I'm a gangster corporate hustler.
Was that frustrating? Was there a point where you were just like, Jesus, that's it? They're not going to, after the first five dozen, I'm not sending you anything else.
You know what? No, it wasn't frustrating at all because. At that point in time in my career, you know, and that was only a few years ago, that was 2011, 2012. But at that point, it was just a habit for me or a mentality that I've adopted where it's like, you're just relentless. It's a relentlessness. You know, it's like, I'll send somebody track ideas for 5-6 years if I have to, because it's not going to hurt me if I stop, and it's not going to hurt me if I continue. So, why stop? You know what I mean? So in that particular case, it was just me just being relentless. Like, here you go. Here's another one. Like Khaled. And another one.
Another one.
Until you catch one, you know? Yeah. So,
are you ever worried that those are ideas you can't get back? Like, you kind of don't know if they're going to use them.
No. I mean, it's all case by case, but with me, it's just like, I mean, obviously the extreme is like, if you have like a track of mine and like you've had it for like 6 months or like a year, like I'm not going to like not use that or think about using that track, you know? But it's case by case. I mean, obviously like when you're sending stuff to Kanye's camp, like you want to give him a little bit of time, you know what I mean?
He's got a couple like, things going on.
Yo, let me know in an hour or it's gone, you know, like, so.
Yeah. But that song also underwent so many changes, right? Mm-hmm. You gave it to them. They said, okay, I like it, but change the snare. We're adding this singing part.
I'm getting this nigga in the morning. He gonna take keeping chief and just too long away.
What was that like? You get it back and then all of a sudden you have to make these big changes after 2 years on a quick schedule.
Yeah. I mean, that's Kanye being Kanye, you know, like, he's in the room. He's in there with Mike Dean. He's in there with Travis Scott and Shea Pope and Rhymefest and the whole crew. And he's being him. You know, he's super creative and super perfectionist. And so I expected it. You know, I knew that it wasn't going to be like, all right, well, he's just going to take this as it is and then like make a song from it. It's like, nah, like this is something that they're going to really dig into. And that's what I appreciate about, one of the things I appreciate about Kanye the most is, you know, he super duper cares about the song, and the music. So he'll go at great lengths just to make sure it's right. And so, yeah, I mean, they put it together, you know, the way they wanted it to, and it worked out. Mm.
So as I'm sitting here, I am staring at a giant logo for yeah. Roseville Music Group. So that's your label. Mm-hmm. What can you tell me about it? And do you ever see a point at which you'll release music you're not directly involved in making?
Yeah, definitely. So Roseville Music Group, at this point, I kind of don't really look at it as a label. It's more of like a creative kind of like a collective of just creatives, you know, artist development. And so it originated from the street that I grew up on. I grew up on Roseville Avenue in Newark, New Jersey, in the hood, baby. The bricks, Brick City.
Shout out to Brick City.
Don't leave your windows down at the stoplight because you'll get got. Anyway, so Roseville Music Group is just, like I said, a collective of just creatives. And so, yeah, I think moving forward, there's a lot of plans that we have, a lot of things that we want to put into motion, that we are putting into motion. And I think over time it's going to evolve into putting out music that I'm not producing. I mean, we're already kind of doing that, not on the retail side, but more on the sort of like free side, building up our SoundCloud. But mm-hmm. yeah, definitely like moving forward into the future, you know, we're going to have more artists signed to us, more music that I may or may not have a hand in, but kind of all making sense mm-hmm. under the umbrella. So.
And Smokey Robotic is a group of yours that I love. Yeah. Shouts
Thank
to
you.
Them. Yeah. So for people who haven't heard them, it's very different than almost anything else you do.
Yeah. Way different. Yeah.
What are they about?
So Smokey Robotic is, I guess, a quote unquote like pop sort of group that I put together back in, I want to say 2009, 2010. And it's consisting of four people, two producers. So me as one producer, and then I have Conrad Old Money from Vancouver, who's the second producer, and then two vocalists. One vocalist is this really amazing singer, soul, songwriter, Father Dude. Who's actually on tour in Australia right now, just dropped a solo single called Eyes on You. And then the other vocalist is Zachary Murdoch, who raps and also sings. And he's got a really like deep kind of voice.
My heart is the vault, real banks. Her love driving me crazy, baby, I need a shrink. Her body is my religion, adrenaline rushing when I'm fucking her, I hit the limit.
Back in 2010, we all kind of like met. I met Zach first, and then I eventually met Father Dude and then Conrad, and we all kind of decided to make this group together. And it was just a kind of organic, natural progression for me, you know, being involved with something so outside of what I was so used to doing. And the same is true for all of them. We kind of came together and it was magic. So, you know, we kind of took a little hiatus. We haven't really made any new music in a while, but, earlier this year, we just talked about getting back together and getting back like Voltron and going back on the Smokey Robotic stuff. So, it's all fun, man. It's like, we have a blast when we're together. So
nice. And on a whiteboard here, I won't mention any names, but I see a big whiteboard that says yep. Illmind album on
oh,
it
yeah.
and a bunch of very exciting names. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously Stoner Raps, still super early, but, you know, earlier this year, I just decided that I need to do an Illmind album. And I feel like now is the time. And, you know, I always had thoughts of eventually doing one. I mean, like, 2 years ago, I wanted to do one. 5 years ago, I wanted to do one. But what stopped me back then was that I felt like I just wasn't ready. I felt like I needed to develop a little bit more. I felt like I wasn't excited enough. So I think now I'm just super excited. I'm really just kind of feeling really good about it. I think I'm at that point in my career where it's time for like an official full Illmind produced album with just a shitload of different artists on there, and it'll be a combination of just, you know, raw hip hop with just like genre bending and just like really, really just taking all of my influences and making one project. So I'm really excited about it.
Awesome. And so what else do you have going on? I know you release new beat tapes all the time and stuff like that. What's coming up?
I'm actually releasing a beat tape this week. I actually haven't released a beat tape in a while. The last release I had was my disco album called 432 earlier this year. So the next project I'm releasing is a beat tape just for the fans, for the streets. It's called 3 a.m. on the West Side Highway. And that's exactly what it sounds like, 3 a.m. in the car on the West Side Highway with the windows down. It's a 10-track beat tape. I'm putting it out on SoundCloud tomorrow, Tuesday, and then retail on Friday, Spotify, Amazon, iTunes, all that stuff. And so we're just gonna feed the streets with the beat tape, you know, see what happens later on in the year, maybe an Illmind album, maybe not till next year, and then just more little things I'm working on. I'm working on some music for a couple movies right now, some more placement stuff. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of business stuff, a lot of, you know, live showcase
of Roseville artists.
Actually, we're working on that in the long term, but we actually just started a bi-weekly event out here in New York City called 8020. And so we have our second show at No Malice Palace in the East Village. So it's basically a party. It's an Illmind party. You come in, it's free to get in. East Village vibes. No egos, none of that. I'm on the turntables. My man DJ Prince is on the turntables, and we just play good music. A combination of my shit with other people's stuff and just stuff we love, and it's just a good time. So, if you're in the area, come through to that party.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks for coming through.
Shout to the Cypher, man, and Illmind, I'm here. Yeah, we got a lot to do, baby.
Things I most love about interviewing producers is seeing their reaction when you bring up their very early work. With Illmind, he was actually surprised and maybe even a little happy to discuss his early career beats. Far more important than all that, though, is his drive. It was an inspiration to me how focused he is on finding out about his audience and on figuring out how he can appeal to them beyond just making beats. His live beat battles, software, and online mentorships are equally great for aspiring producers and for his bottom line. And although I can't tell you who was on Illmind's vision board of potential collaborators for his upcoming solo album, trust me when I tell you, you will not want to miss it. The Cypher is on our summer schedule for July and August, so join us in 2 weeks when our guest will be David Banner. We'll discuss his whole career, from his underrated first group, Crooked Letters, all the way to his upcoming album, The God Box. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/TheCypherShow if you enjoy the program, and you can help us out there for as little as $1 a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
Don't leave your windows down at the stoplight, because you'll get got.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
It's like transforming a fruit into, you know, a sauce.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Mono MP3s at like super low quality.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
I remember leaving my AOL AIM screen name signed in, and like I'd come home and see like 10 MP3s on my desktop from Ninth Wonder because he just sent me a bunch of beats.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Josh Halzak.
They only can hear my music when I get a placement.
And an extra special thanks to Richard Dean, a.k.a. Yams, for making this episode happen.
No one knows this.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
That's not going for the club either.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.